Hi, and welcome. This is Dave. Who's here?
Well, hi, Emily's here.
Hi, Emily. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Thank you.
Well, bring us up to date. What's going on for you?
I gave a sample session last week to a sample client, and I found it kind of challenging, but by the end, the client said he was very happy. I had a hard time clarifying what the agenda was. So I think I kept going, not really understanding what his agenda was. And I asked him what he wanted to talk about, and he said, nothing really, just about, I'm feeling kind of mad that I'm not on vacation for spring break because my kid didn't want to go. And so,
would you like to look at that and talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I'd like to figure out where.
Because I think
yeah.
It might be helpful to Robin
Others.
And Paolo as well, because you're all doing sample sessions. First of all, the best preparation you can make for a sample session when you book the time and have the agreement that either the client will call you or you're going to meet with a client is to prepare the client in two ways. One is, I think it will give us both the best idea of what it would be like to work together in coaching if you have a specific agenda item that you'd like us to focus on. Okay, that does two things. It lets the client know this is a pre-qualifying conversation, the purpose of which is to see if both of you believe that it would be helpful to work together in coaching, and it gives the client a time to think about what he wants to talk about, to begin to think about a specific agenda. And the second thing is, and it would be helpful to have an idea of where you'd like us to get to during that time, so that you have an appointment, you have a specified time, and I think you definitely need to keep that time. If you settle on 20 minutes, you need to stick to that. If it's 30 minutes, stick to it. And the two questions. Now, did you ask him, or did you mention did you mention those two things that really?
I did. I said, and then he said, well, okay, well, just today, just right now.
Okay, let me interrupt you now, because when you began to say, well, what would you like to talk about? That sounds like a couple of buddies. Now, you're a professional coach, so the question is, what have you decided you'd like to for us to specifically focus on today?
Okay.
So you want to follow up that question with a specific agenda focus of what do you want us to focus on? And then it's harder for him to just start, well, I'm really upset I'm not on spring vacation. Is there something about that you would like us to focus on for this?
Well, we did. We got to that. And then it was.
How long did it take you?
Maybe like 10, like 5 minutes.
Okay. This is to get it down to 15 to 20 seconds. Because how long did you set the time for?
Oh, we talked for like.
No. I'm not asking you that. How long did you set the time for before the session? How long did you indicate the session would last?
Oh, to him?
Yeah.
And we talked for an hour.
And that's not what I'm asking you. Do you hear my question and do you hear your answer?
No, I don't.
And that's separate? Did you, before you met with him, I'm going to be tough on you because I think this is important and I think it leads to higher conversion. So I'm going to continue to be tough. When I ask you, did you set a specific time before you met? Did you?
I guess I don't understand your question.
When you set up a time for him to meet Tuesday at 3 o'clock, did you say how long the session was going to be? We'll meet for 30 minutes or we'll meet
yes.
for 20 minutes. How long did you set it for?
50 minutes.
50 minutes. Did you stick to it?
Yes.
Well, I mean, if you have that long and it's a single agenda, that may not be an efficient use of time, but you don't have to be that spiffy. I would recommend that it be more of a laser coaching session that you get a good idea, because when if you have a 50-minute session with a client, you're going to deal with two or three topics. So you want
right,
to give
right.
the client the best idea of what it's going to be like to work together. So those two questions is preparation, a specific time, how you're going to meet, if he's going to call you or whatever, and how long it'll be. Then when you meet, you begin immediately with the first question and then the second question. So is there any way that it would be helpful for us to focus on how that could be spiffied up? What do you have any questions at this point of how you might have made it an even better experience?
I have a lot of questions, but I don't want to take up your time.
Can you focus them?
Well, the first was starting the agenda. When he was talking, I kept saying something specific, and he just said, well, I'm feeling bad. I can't go on spring break. And I said,
so
is that really
what...
How
did you respond to that?
I asked if that's really what's bothering him. And he said, well, actually, you know, I'm just feeling... I'm the life of the party, and all my friends are down there, and I'm not there to party and have fun. I'm like, so... Then I
okay, may I
questions.
Interrupt you?
Yes.
Okay, remember, this is not therapy, and it's not just him having a catharsis of his feelings. This is a coaching session. So
that's what I felt like. I didn't know where to stop him then. Like, I didn't know, yeah.
Well, I'd stop him in the first sentence. All my friends are, what specifically would you like us to focus on? See, I think he's showing you what it's like to be him. That he
exactly.
has something getting, he has trouble getting things done because he's in a state of mind that would be, now, here's what I would do. I would offer a single empathic comment, like, I hear how frustrating that must be to not be where you want to be. Now, what would you like us to focus on in this coaching session? And to continue his feelings, if he continues that, you, I believe, would interrupt him again to say, you know, I understand your feelings. What would you like us to focus on that you can do in a proactive way to take steps to...
I did ask him that specifically, and he said, well, if you can give me that answer, I'd pay you $1 million. He's like, no one, he's like, there's nothing you can do. So then I was like, okay.
What was frustrating. The question you asked when he said, give me the answer? Well, that's okay.
He just complained about being happy, and he was just kept saying, like,
okay, here's a thought about that. I would, after, if an empathic comment or two didn't help him get centered or create a common ground together, I would ultimately, if he kept going and say, well, if you had the answer, well, you're creating your story. Whatever you think and feel and experience, you're creating. You're creating something you don't like. That's
right,
exactly
right.
What I do as a professional coach.
Yeah, I try that, yeah.
Focus on to create a different experience that you can do,
So he did mention, like, fitness, and he has diabetes, and so to me, I knew that was the bigger problem. Like, he wasn't down at the desert hiking with his friends because he physically can't.
I want to ask you, Emily, are you really understanding what I'm saying about an empathic resonance and to focus on the agenda item and to give him his story and to look at what he can be effective in creating? Because your answer, your responses show me exactly what he did with you, and he wasn't getting it. So do you understand what I'm saying about making him the point of reference and having him take ownership for his story and to look at what he's doing that's creating the result that he doesn't like? Does that make sense to you?
it does make sense, but I couldn't get that across, and he, yeah, so I feel that it's not working.
Did you ask him in that way?
Sort of.
Okay. Okay, well, think about...
I guess I know him more a friend, and I know he's really depressed, so maybe he's not the right person for me to talk to, because he kept saying, there's really nothing I can complain about, and it was all about, you know.
In over 11 years of coaching, I've never met a single client or talked with a single potential client who I did not think was coachable and for whom I did not recommend coaching. There have been two people that I recommended a parallel or an initial consultation with a psychiatrist because there was a story that was ongoing that precluded engaging in a meaningful story with me. Both of those were addictions, but I think that, there may be occasional uncoachable clients. I haven't seen one yet. So I think he's coachable, but I think you have to really address it in a specific way and move entirely to being a professional coach with him and move away from the mindset of friendship.
I did ask him specifically what was bothering him today or what you want to talk about, and he said, well, I'm getting over my shingles.
That's not a coaching question.
Okay.
I want you to understand what I'm saying because that's a friend or a therapy question. That's not a coaching question. That doesn't offer him anything other than he begins to tell you all the stuff that's bothering him. He's going to answer your question. He's doing his job. When you ask him what's bothering him, he's going to elaborate about all the stuff that everybody's been doing and all of this stuff. So you don't have a coaching client yet. You don't have a coaching conversation yet. Does that part make sense to you, Emily?
Right. So I'm being too broad. I seem to say a specific item to work on.
It's not broad or narrow. It's giving him the point of reference to make it his story to look at what you want to do to frame it as a coaching conversation. If you got narrower, you might say, what specifically are you feeling now? That's not the issue. It's to make it a coaching conversation, not a friend or a therapy conversation. You want him to take ownership of the story he's writing, and I haven't heard that yet from him. What's the next step? What happened? What was the outcome? Did he decide to be a client or what?
No, he wants to come. He thought it was great. And I was like, well, I didn't really feel like there was a coachable moment. And he's like, are you kidding me? He's like, just venting to you. Like, I don't want to be vented to.
Okay.
Like, so I feel like I didn't do it right.
What's your plan?
I don't know.
Do you recommend coaching to him and set a fee and establish a time and a framework?
No.
How did you end it?
I was going to do another sample session with him.
Okay. I'd only recommend one sample session. I'd recommend a sample session of not more than 30 minutes. But when you do another one, try what we're talking about to get him to focus specifically, make it a coaching conversation, and allow a few minutes at the end to recommend coaching and what the framework would be for coaching, including what he does, standing time, weekly, or whatever you decide, and your fee. Does that make sense to you?
It does, yeah.
Tell me what happened there, because you don't sound very excited. What happened? Are you not interested in seeing him as a client, or tell me what your response is.
I don't know. I guess I don't get it.
I'm being critical to you? I know we only have a short amount of time, and I'm coming on in a strong way, hopefully to be helpful, and hopefully whatever I say is not going to be heard as pejorative or critical, but helpful to you, because I know we don't have very long to discuss this. So I think you've got a beginning with him. You have another sample session. You have a shot at, you know, really developing a coaching conversation and have him be a professional coaching client. So I think that's great news. Does that make sense so far?
It makes sense. I just don't feel like I can charge him a session. I don't feel like I'm even getting it myself.
Well,
I thought I understood the process.
You're giving him one more sample session, so you're not charging for that, but you're talking about beginning an engagement with him.
Correct.
Uh-huh. You want to give us a report on that at the beginning of the next session?
Sure.
Okay. Has Paola arrived? Okay. Robin, what about you? Give us an update.
Hello, I'm here.
Welcome.
Thank you. I don't have much of an update in terms of coaching. The client that I have is moved to a different job. It's actually a good thing, because that was part of what we were working on, his career goals. And so he has a new job, and so he's in the transition stage now. So I'll catch up with him in another 2 weeks.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to report before you do your roadmap case study?
No, actually.
Okay. Are you ready to begin with your case study?
Yes, I am.
Super. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm doing a my money story, and I'll begin. My name is Robin, and I'm 50 years old and married for 10 years. I grew up an only child in a working class family in Maryland. My mom and dad worked several jobs during my childhood, and I was a latchkey kid from the age of 11. My childhood was frequently solitary, one of many books, puzzles, dolls, and games. Christmas brought a generous amount of toys and clothes. I always knew the toys came from my fun-loving, attentive dad, and the clothes came from my practical, distant mom. As a kid, I valued the toys the most, and I was very close with my father. My mother and I had a very rocky relationship from my childhood through the majority of my adulthood. Occasionally, I would overhear my parents discuss finances. My mom would voice her concerns over money, and my dad would reassure her that everything was just fine. As I became a teenager, Christmases and my parents' spending in general became significantly more curbed and low-key. My mom told me I wasn't a child anymore, and I needed to focus on school. I was very aware from my mom that she and my dad had decided to send me to a private high school. I knew this was a big deal and that they sacrificed a great deal to put me there. In my small private school, each of my fellow 43 students were from the wealthiest families in the county. I was picked on because of the clothes I wore and laughed at because neither of my parents were doctors or lawyers or executives. I became acutely aware of our different lifestyles. I had chores to do, and they had live-in help and never made a bed or washed a dish. They believed such activities and the people who engaged in them to be beneath them. I remember deciding that my classmates were a bunch of spoiled brats, and I was glad that I was not like them, even though inside I secretly envied their lives and how they were so lucky to have been born in a rich family. I graduated from high school and had no problem getting accepted into several good universities. I first went to a private College of Worcester and then transferred to Penn State, but found I was not prepared or responsible enough to be successful. Neither of my parents went to college and assumed I could figure things out on my own. And even though I graduated from a prestigious college prep high school, I was not prepped for living on my own and making responsible choices. I remember going to a local department store by myself for the first time and applying for its credit card. I was amazed that I could show this card and in exchange, I'd get the things I wanted. I knew somewhere in the back of my mind that a bill would come, but didn't give it as much thought as I did of how cool a shopping experience could be with a charge card. My mom and dad never talked to me about money or paying bills or finances at all. So while they never complained about money, I never learned anything about how to save or manage money from my parents. As an adult, I lived my money story somewhat like having my head buried in the sand. In owning my present story, I see that I have consistently avoided dealing with the realities of my financial situation. I got an entry-level position in human resources in the federal government and was thrilled to be able to move out and get my own apartment with two roommates. My transition was sometimes rocky, as I had a tendency to not pay attention to my checking account balance and bounced checks on several occasions. Slowly and over time, I realized the importance of maintaining a roof over my head and became more responsible in paying bills on time and ensuring I had the funds to cover every check I wrote. When I was 26, I bought a house. By this time, I was in the process of repairing my credit from the previous 7 to 8 years, and I thought I was doing great because I kept a positive balance in my checking account from one paycheck to the next, and I paid my bills on time. My credit score rose above the good level, and I had several major credit cards with generous limits, a testament, I thought, to my fiscal responsibility. I married at 40, and my husband and I live in the same house I bought at 26. We've refinanced twice and have taken equity out to pay credit card balances that seem to perpetually creep up and to make updates and improvements to our house. Twice I've taken out loans from my thrift savings plan, each time paying off approximately $40,000 in credit card bills. I handled the finances, paid bills on time, but the balances always seemed to grow, and I kept this to myself. In assessing the storylines and plot, I come to terms with the fact that the overwhelming majority of spending is mine alone. Buying things gave me comfort when I was anxious or sad. It made me feel better about myself. Though my spending is typically on house decorations and updating wardrobes for me and my husband James, I've spent easily thousands on self-help books, programs, seminars, and trainings. Often I would purchase the programs and let them sit on my bookshelves as though I would gain its benefits through osmosis. Just having them there was a comfort to me. I've become very anxious over the state of our finances. While presently our credit card balances are nowhere near where they used to be, I still carry much more debt than I should. I realize our savings account sits at $8,000, sometimes a little less if I need to dip into it to carry me to the next pay period. I've become frightened by the fact that if anything tragic happened to either one of us, we could become financially ruined. I became so anxious in my life, but kept it all inside. At the age of 50, I'm ashamed and embarrassed that I have very little savings and still carry too much debt. I'm equally ashamed that I've kept the state of our finances from James. I decided to let go of this secrecy and speak openly to him. It was so hard to do. I felt like I failed him because from the beginning, I assured him that we were always doing just fine, just like my dad reassured my mom. And an interesting aside is after my dad died in 2007, I was in my parents' garage helping my mom clear out boxes and boxes of old items and paperwork from many years back. I came across a box of letters, bills, and other papers, and I became curious about and began reading. In the paperwork, I discovered my parents almost lost their home twice and at times had difficulty paying their bills on time. I could see how alike my father and I were in our attitudes towards money and how we engaged in avoidance. Talking to James and telling him the truth turned out to be incredibly cathartic and relieving. He actually felt bad that I put so much pressure on myself and he thought all along that we were in much better shape. His compassion and support was humbling and incredibly gratifying, but he made it clear that we were a partnership, and as such, we would journey together to where we want to be. I recognized the huge energetic component to my thoughts and beliefs and statements that have shaped my money story. Like the unconscious alliance I made as a young person in high school to my parents, my family, my social class, I had a need to belong, and I saw that I'd taken certain beliefs that go with this group, that the rich were lucky, that living paycheck to paycheck was the way of the world. I decided I belonged to this group and created a feeling of pride in so belonging. And as such, even though I brought in a good salary, I couldn't seem to save money and kept on spending. I realized that if I did anything different, I'd break from this group because our kind of people didn't have money. We always complained of just making ends meet, and we always lived paycheck to paycheck. James and I are carving out new experiences in this story, and sharing my new money story with my husband was a first step. Together, we will see a financial planner and take steps to improve our financial literacy. And my next client will be my husband, James, in living a new life story. My focus now is on being a great money manager and enjoying my life. I feel a greater compassion for myself for never having cultivated the skills of managing money effectively. And I honor my father and my mother for their struggles and their desire to give me more than they had. Through this program, I've started to get a clearer picture of my finances and how I've been carrying these beliefs that have been keeping me stuck and running in circles. It's been enlightening, humbling, and powerful. And I am grateful to Dr. Kruger for developing this program. And that's the end.
Thank you very much. A very moving story. I appreciate you sharing it.
Thanks. I didn't expect to get emotional, but...
I'm sorry. Say it again, please. I didn't quite hear you.
I said I didn't expect to get emotional.
It's a very powerful story.
It tends to be like that.
Story. Thank you for the vulnerability of sharing it with us. Let's open it up. Sure. Any other comments or thoughts or questions from anyone? Emily, did you have any comments?
I don't have any comments. I can relate to you a lot, though, because I kind of have felt that in my life also as a single mom.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Nothing. That's okay.
Robin, did you use the roadmap system in constructing that? I wasn't quite clear. Is it visually represented in the roadmap system, or how would I know that you used the roadmap in constructing that?
I did use the roadmap, and I also used the module on mapping a new money story.
Uh-huh.
I did the exercises in that, and if I send it to you, I can kind of show you, like, what belongs under what category.
Yeah, it's a powerful story, and thank you very much again for sharing it. It's really terrific. Yeah, I look forward to seeing it. It's great. Any other thoughts or comments or questions from anyone? Okay, well, I want to move into our material today on career story. This is we're at module 7. We're at session 9, so we have three more seminars after this. We're talking today about a new career story. Now, each of you is uniquely positioned to help a client navigate a career assessment and change, if that's what they're focusing on. It's a familiar experience for each of us. You're in the middle of it right now, as a matter of fact. As we discuss aspects of a new career story, reflect on your own experiences of transition to professional coaching, and you'll have a sense of resonance with your clients who navigate their own paths in this regard. First, some thoughts about passion and flow, then we'll roadmap a new career story, and then discuss your coaching practice and marketing, because this is a good place to add some aspects of that. And I appreciate Emily bringing up something where we could sort of get into that more this session, because I know that we don't look at a great deal about developing coaching skills or about marketing or business, but I want to add some here. So first, about passion. Every success story is a love story. Bob Costas on Tim Russert's death captured his passion and his infectious enthusiasm. Costas said, he told me once, Bob, other than my family, I don't want to be any place but here. All truly successful people live in alignment with their passions. They're fulfilling their purpose in life, living their dreams. Rick Miller's research on the key to happiness and peace of mind in his book Massive Success studied the secret of the world's wealthiest people to become successful. They may not know themselves, they may be caught up in what they do each day, and be unaware of the elements of exactly how they become successful. But one thing they have in common, they have discovered their why. They have aligned their purpose with their passions. The famous theologian William Barclay said, there are two great days in a person's life, the day we were born and the day we discover why. Consider the inverse. The number one reason people don't get what they want is they don't know exactly what they want. So, to talk about flow now. Flow is a state of heightened focus, productivity, and even happiness. The ability to create flow, to be more productive, creative, and satisfied at work offers significant advantages. Flow is really a state of mind. It's one of the positive states that's been studied in the last couple of decades that creates so much to effectiveness and performance. So flow, from another perspective, is a state of mind of being centered and focused without distraction. This state of mind allows full immersion in the process of concentration and performance that creates superior results. In the state of mind of flow, people engage so fully in what they do that they may even lose track of time. The experience becomes its own reward, a way of countering distraction and becoming immersed in purpose. So let's do a roadmap of a career story and apply it in this way to look at some possibilities and just some practical application and discussion. We'll discuss it from the perspective of working with clients and talk about a roadmap that could apply to a career transition of any sort. First, recognize your career story. If you were to configure it as a shape, what would it be? A trajectory? A circle? A bell curve? A flat line? Clearly describe your career story as it exists now. Then describe what you would want in a new career story. If someone wants to make a career change, are they fully informed about the one they're in now and wanting to leave? For example, if someone has only performed at 80 or 85% capacity, concluded that their job or career is not rewarding, then decide to move on, they don't have the information needed. They can't make an informed decision of what it's like to operate at 100% capacity. To do an apples-to-apples comparison, they would have to function at 100% of their capacity in their current career to contrast it with the anticipation of 100% capacity in a new career. It's likely that the same process that resulted in a ceiling at 80% would be repeated in the new situation. So, a question here. At what percent of your capacity are you functioning in your work now? And always, I've never asked this question of an individual I'm coaching that they haven't immediately set a figure. It's like they've thought about it, calculated it, and planned it, but they immediately say, they'll say 75% or 60% or 90%. So If it's not 100%, explore why. That's your immediate coachable moment. Have you ever performed at 100% of your capacity? Do you know what it's like to be fully successful in your current or even a past position so you can make an informed decision? Here's a brief story to illustrate. At the beginning of my career as a psychiatrist, for a small part of my professional time, I served as consultant to the Institute of Rehabilitation and Research, the same place that Representative Gabby Gifford spent so much time here in Houston, working with people who had become physically disabled in adolescence or adulthood, often as a result of an accident. Not surprisingly, some of these individuals considered suicide as an alternative to lifetime disability. Instead of trying to convince them not to kill themselves, as other physicians, as family and friends did, I indicated that I could understand their feelings about the overwhelming change in their life, that suicide was at least one way they could control something about their life, especially when fundamental body control was out of reach. I recognized that at that moment in time, the idea of suicide, of being able to control one thing in their lives to know they could end the pain and feel effective, was the hope that paradoxically allowed them to keep living. They needed that choice to feel effective. I recommended that we work together to achieve their full capacity now, recognizing that it was at a different level since the onset of disability. Only by achieving their full potential at their new level could they make an informed decision about whether they truly wanted to live or not live as a disabled individual. I told them that I would entirely understand if, after achieving full capacity and then being able to make an informed decision, that if they decided to die, I would respect that decision. I worked with several hundred people over a period of 5 years. Thankfully, no one decided to die after going through full physical and emotional rehabilitation and achieving a new, though different, level of function. Next step, own your needs and ideals regarding career, your career story. Be clear about needs and ideals, if and how they align with passion and experience, and ultimately strategy and goals. When your passion and expertise combine, terrific possibilities emerge. So a question here, what do you want in your career? And listen for whether the client is getting away from something or going towards something, or rarely both. Distinguish temporary frustration from permanent dissatisfaction. And be cautious about confusing dissatisfaction, disillusionment, or a slow period with terminal disillusionment. Before you can distinguish temporary from permanent, you may need to realign or recommit to your career. And keep in mind that choosing the wrong career may be every bit as easy as it was the first time if you chose the wrong career then. One client spoke of a particular storyline she had bought into. She was not addicted to work itself, to money, or the things that money bought, but felt she was addicted to the pursuit of perfection, her work ethic. More became a goal. More money, more work. The story of the pursuit of money had become a substitute for other stories. The ideal of more, of course, lacked an endpoint, so her self-esteem was never validated. Next step, assess what is present and what is missing in a current career. What information do you need? Research new information regarding personal skills, abilities, aptitudes. So questions here. What would your career and life be like if you already had what you wanted? And secondly, what is it costing you personally and financially to not have what you want? And here it may be important to distinguish internal dissatisfaction from job dissatisfaction. Internal struggles and unhappiness are often blamed on a job or a marriage. People want to change the obvious external cause rather than to look inside. Sometimes people even create job-related struggles to externalize unhappiness or conflict in an attempt to escape or to oppose a recognizable remedy. Then the supposed way to get rid of the problem is to leave it, a geographic cure. Next step, decide on a plan and how to make it work. A question here, how would working with me get you where you want to be? Now, back to that client who was addicted to work and had a goal of more without an endpoint. I noticed a pattern that as soon as she was really enjoying her work, really immersed in it, she would begin procrastinating. She would put off completing something at work, which restored her old feeling of dread and vague guilt about what she should be doing. When I pointed out this pattern, she recognized it. It prompted her insight. She said, work always needed to be work. The minute I began to feel pleasure at work, I began to feel vaguely guilty because I should be working. A possibility here, create a vision. Create a vision of success at your specific goals. Identify and include all the sensory detail, all the experiences of successfully arriving at your goal. Review it twice a day. Having a plan supersedes motivation and not feeling like doing something. For example, if your plan is that every Monday from 3 to 5 p.m. you work on your marketing, you may not feel like it, you may not be motivated, but if it's Monday at 3 o'clock, you stick to your plan. Remember, you don't need to be motivated, you just need a plan and to stick to it. Next step, map your plan. Where, when, how to begin. SMART goals, initiatives, next best action. Now, here's some compelling research that validates the impact of having a specific goal. Now, it's not research from a white coat sterile medical lab, but it's kind of close. The image of a black housefly was etched into each urinal at the Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. The theory was that while men may not pay attention to where they aim, if they have a specific target, a goal, they will focus more specifically. The theory of the originator, Ad Kaboom, proved correct. It reduced spillage by 80%. Choice architecture is an art and a science. People can be nudged toward decisions that will improve their lives in healthy and wealthy directions. We're susceptible to biases that can lead us to make decisions that are at times unhealthy or uneconomical, even short-sighted. When we consider how people think, we can design or co-create environments and frameworks of choice that make it easier for people to pick better options. This is what the whole field of behavioral economics is about. Next step, author changes. Implement the plan to reach your goal. Someone needs the correct paradigm. Changing careers means changing paradigms. A mistake of extrapolation would be to assume that the present experience would apply to a new career, you just change the setting. Even if you go, and this is from one client, even if you go from head of HR at one large oil company to another in the same city, the culture is worlds apart. The correct paradigm would be not only about the process, but the content of the new career as well as the process of change. Assumptions within a paradigm need to be examined for their correctness. There were two different cultures, so two different frameworks, even though it was the same position, and both were large oil companies. For example, in making a transition from medical practice to coaching, I assumed getting clients would be similar to getting therapy in analytic patients. For me, that was to share my work and thinking, to occasionally present a paper or write a book. My secretary would take the calls, put patients on the schedule or the waiting list usually. Well, wrong for coaching. Coaching is a profession, but it's also a business. Marketing is a world of difference. My mentor coach drugged me kicking and screaming into marketing until I finally found a way to make it fun. So a question here may be, who else needs to be involved in your plan? And finally, program new experiences to then incorporate them into your identity. considerations of a career need to be considered in conjunction with developmental phases of the individual within that career, as well as where the individual is in life development. Needs and ideals need to be considered in terms of the life phase of where someone is. In other words, the developmental issue is more in the foreground at a certain life phase, like midlife versus later in life, may determine how someone views a career, the challenges, or the desire to change careers. Here's how one transformation sounds. This is from Julia Cameron in a terrific book you may be familiar with, it called The Artist's Way. I'm astounded I could let go of the drama of being a suffering artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. So the process of coaching with your clients will parallel other processes. This is part of what I mean when I say a client will always teach you exactly what it's like to be him. For example, Emily's client shows her what it's like to be him, that he wants to have catharsis of his feelings rather than own the story and structure something that creates a different story, one that he would more likely want to inhabit. One would be aligned with his needs and his ideals. So, if a client is stuck in coaching, they're stuck in their life or their business. Other parallels. Where they're stuck in coaching will reveal where they're stuck in their life or their business. If they don't fill out the paperwork in coaching, look to see if they're filling out the paperwork in their life. If they don't pay in coaching, look for the parallel process. If someone is frustrating you, look at how they're teaching others as well as you how to respond to them in a particular way. Now, here are a couple of things I want to mention that I think are important in coaching a new story, especially in a career story. One is diagnosis bias. The moment we label a person or situation, we seek data to support that diagnosis more vigorously than data to contradict. This bias induces blindness to all evidence that contradicts an objective assessment of a person or situation. A diagnosis bias is simply a mental shortcut in making decisions. It's an illustration of how we construct meaning for our experiences. We organize and simplify by using a shortcut. It's efficient, it's parsimonious, it's adaptive. For example, once we conclude something and label it, we don't have to go through the whole process each time. And once the shortcut of the label is there, we don't even notice things that are outside the scope of the decision. So usually it works in a very efficient and effective manner because you don't have to go through the whole process and discover the Pacific Ocean every time. You just see it and act on it. Now, the usefulness of this mechanism is evident, and there's so much information that we're unable to take it all in, and we'd be bombarded and unable to function. But we always have to be aware of what we might be overlooking. Now, closely related is the confirmation bias, in which we cherry-pick data to support an assumption or belief that we already have. Now, here's a study that illustrates that. Psychologist Franz Epting devised a study that set up a blind date with a prior description of that blind date. A mutual friend describes the date as smart, funny, and interesting. Now, if she says her plans for the weekend are, well, what I do every weekend, stay home and read Hegel, the most common response was to appreciate her intellect and deadpan sense of humor about referring to a philosopher. Now, on the other hand, consider the framework here. If the friend, instead of describing her as smart, funny, and interesting, describes her as smart, serious, and interesting, the comments were more likely, how much Hegel can one person read? One participant's comment even captured the trend. You know, I ended up racking my brain about the difference between Heidegger and Hegel and decided to just leave before dessert. The description determines subsequent perception. Now, here's another consideration, value attribution. These are ways that we think that we need to be aware of to not create blind spots. We tend to imbue a person or a thing with certain qualities based on the initial perceived value. This is the role of assumptions in action. Let me tell you a study to illustrate this. Two economists, Barry Starr and Ha Huang, studied skill categories and statistics of new NBA players beginning 1984. They distilled these statistics into three skill measuring categories: scoring, quickness, and toughness, and included all the things in each of these, like scoring was points per minute, free throw percentage, field goal, quickness was assists and steals, toughness was rebounds and blocks per minute. They looked at all the variables that determined playing times in games: skill categories, players' performance, injury or trade status. But there was one variable that had greater impact than all of these performance data. It was the player's draft selection order. In fact, draft order was more highly correlated with playing time throughout the first 5 years in the NBA, which is as long as they studied these statistics. So even though skill and performance determines a draft order, once picked, coaches and managers should only be interested in the player's performance. In other words, once the draft is over, the draft number is history and performance is everything else. Not so, says value attribution. This is a particular bias that we have. Now, I want to talk some about your coaching practice, this aspect of your new career. Now, remember, you're not selling anything. You're offering value and highlighting benefits. There are a couple of factors necessary to make coaching work. Your client is willing to grow, and there's a gap between where the client is now and where they want to be. So the coaching engagement can be crystallized by focusing on one or both of these issues. What's the biggest challenge you're facing now in your life or in your business? And where ideally would you like to be in 6 months or in a year? Now, when you bring value, rather than selling and asking for the sale or closing the sale or even asking for the business, as a professional, you make a recommendation. Think of other professionals, your physician, your dentist, your CPA, an attorney. They don't try to sell you anything. They have a discussion, do an assessment, and on the basis of a professional opinion, make a recommendation. Then you choose to follow it or not. Same in my view with coaching. Now, here's my bias, even though I know that some people do this. A dentist doesn't offer you the platinum, gold, or silver package. They offer a professional assessment and a recommendation. You decide if and when. As a professional coach, you make a specific recommendation of how to work, the frequency, and what's involved. That includes your fee and how to pay the fee. So I don't tend to offer a smorgasbord of options to a client. I make a specific recommendation. Now, this consistently comes up as I mentor coaches and other professionals, so I want to briefly mention it. There's a formula for determining your coaching fee. There are three variables. There are only three, actually, when you think about it: your yearly income, your number of clients, and your fee. Now, let's make this easy and say we'll calculate this only based on the number of individual coaching clients. And we know that there are many ways you can leverage your impact and time and income and benefit to clients, such as group coaching, such as workshops, a number of things. But just for purposes of discussion, yearly income, number of clients, and fee. So pick any of these two that are the most important variables for you personally and professionally, and you calculate the third. For example, if you want to determine a fee, if you decide you want to make $200,000 a year in your coaching practice, that you want to work 11 months a year, and you want to see 15 clients each month on a weekly basis, then the calculation would be you'd need to charge each client a monthly retainer of $1,215. So, again, consider there are many ways of delivering services and to leverage your impact and income: group coaching, facilitation, mastermind groups, teleseminars, seminars, workshops, webinars, speaking. There are additional services you can offer, a virtual firm with referral fees, products, e-courses, paid website, book, e-book. You can create a tangible process for your coaching practice, such as the 28-session template that you have the outline for when you signed up and maybe downloaded that that outline. That works really well. I've seen a number of people. I've used it in coaching groups to have a workbook like the workbook you have and a 28-week protocol, because there are assignments from each for each week from that workbook based on the roadmap system. We can talk about that at a different time if you're interested. Next, let's talk a little bit about your business story. Each encounter with a client is a short story with a beginning, a narrative, and an ending, and a memory that lingers on. Each professional relationship becomes a story arc of development. Your business is a story. Storytelling excellence is not something you just pick up along the way. It's an art, a craft, a discipline to be mastered. A story is a useful way to think of your business. So, what's the story of your business? Are the benefits clear? What's the story of your teleseminar, your training course? Is your story animated and engaging, effective, exciting, promising? Whoever has the best story wins. Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman, he's a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize in Economics, finds that our memories are very selective. And I recently heard him present these findings. Specifically, no matter how extended an event, whether that's a party, a commercial transaction, a presentation, any encounter, we form our views and make our evaluations based on dramatically skewing two things, overweighting two things, the most intense moments and the final moments. And specifically, the final moments are particularly important because after an extended presentation or dinner party, what we may remember will be the few words or the brief exchange at the end. The great way we felt that retrospectively elevates the value of the entire experience. He gave an example. He was attending a symphony in which there was a 45-minute absolutely engaging an exhilarating performance, and then there was an intermission. But for about 1 or 2 seconds right at the end, before intermission, there was a screech of one violin. He noticed that at intermission, this was all anyone was talking about, was how that screech really ruined the performance, when in fact, people had 44.8 minutes of exhilarating experience and a 1 or 2 second screech, but that's how they retrospectively colored the entire experience. So plan your story all the way through to the end. Make your story memorable, compelling, and emotionally engaging. Consider your last impression. Memories matter. Endings matter. Memories are best created with balanced learning, right brain emotional plus left brain, reason and logic. I want to mention something here about brand, because it's something that I just don't see discussed very much, especially in coaching. A brand is the identity, the personality of a product or business. It's the essence of your business story. The signatures of paintings on famous artists can be viewed as an early branding tool. A brand is a valuable element of the identity of a business as well as of its marketing. A brand is an emblem of the impressions of a product or company. It's a metaphor for expectations. Now, brand is not something you'll see specifically addressed. You won't see on somebody's website what their brand is. Brand is an internal organizer. It's an organizer for everything that you do, every communication you have, everything that you offer. So think about the associations you have to brands. What's the first word or phrase you think of for these brands? Nice. Is there a question? Does someone have a question? Then you need to mute for the background noise because we're picking up a conversation. And mute is star six. FedEx. Oprah. Nike, probably performance. FedEx, probably on-time or dependable service. Oprah, inspiration, information to have a better life. So as you go through your day tomorrow, think about the brands that really speak to you, the ones that cause you to buy and later wonder why or later tell yourself why. You are your brand. Your mindset will define your brand. So what's your promise? The answer is your brand. Your brand is the organizer, the internal organizer for everything you do, every connection with potential clients and readers, including website, blog, articles, emails even. Your brand triggers meaning and connection and carries its own value. Brand awareness is the link in the consumer's brain between the brand name and logo to certain associations about the product or service. And think about this. What's the opposite of a brand? The answer is generic. Our clients, our potential clients, consciously and unconsciously take notes on how we brand, on how we value ourselves, how we charge what we're worth, and handle how we handle the business of coaching. How we handle this will determine if we have clients and how successful we and they are. So I want to talk a little bit before we end about business development. Any business becomes successful by clearly defining three aspects: ideas, process, and action. Idea. A specific, simple idea begins the vision of what you provide people, what are the challenges you help them solve, and the clarity of benefits for both your clients and yourself. Albert Einstein said, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. Two is process. The process of your business begins by defining why your business exists, what you want your client to experience, and what you want them to walk away with, as well as return for and refer back to. W. Edward Deming said, if you can't describe what you're doing as a process, then you don't know what you're doing. So the process can include two essential ingredients: imagination, your ability to form images and ideas, especially of things you may have never seen or experienced directly in terms of business success. Now, we can only imagine from our present system, so you have to allow yourself to imagine beyond that system, beyond your current experience, in order to know where you want to grow. Einstein said, imagination's everything. It's the preview of life's coming attractions. And secondly, belief. The acceptance in your mind that you bring immense value to your clients. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. Belief is the power behind every behavior, every step you take. Frank Lloyd Wright said, the thing always happens that you really believe in, and the belief in a thing makes it happen. And the third is action. The world rewards action. We can foster change by conscious practices and effective tools. An infinite sea of new patterns and possibilities can be created to further new goals. Because there's a natural resistance to change, it's only through determined and consistent action that new scripts are written to replace old stories and that new behaviors diminish old habits. Now, there are no shortcuts, since long-term change requires consistent practice, repetition, to groove new neuronal pathways and establish new neural networks. But there are, as you know, effective and efficient methods to accelerate optimum change and ensure transformation. We've heard already two compelling roadmap case presentations that really illustrate this. So, put your plan into action. Then you can always self-correct as you move forward. Malcolm Gladwell, in his book Outliers, talks about how remarkable success in an area is not the result of genius or exceptional talent or remarkable luck. It's hard work. Research shows again and again that excellence at performing a complex task requires a minimum of 10,000 hours for true expertise. This is as true for baseball players as it is for writers, composers, chess players, master criminals. 10,000 hours of practice to achieve mastery associated with being a world-class expert. And so many of the experiences that you had leading up to coaching count dramatically toward that 10,000 hours and the application in coaching. So just a quick word about marketing. If you market the way you like, you'll find a way to enjoy doing it and your practice will grow. Put your plan, your marketing plan into a written structure that you can follow. Just as an architect needs a blueprint to build a house or an author works from a book outline to write a book, your plan, your business plan, will be a template for the structure building your business. Remember that goals are reached one action at a time. If you have one goal each day, in 7 days, you'll have completed 7 actions. At the end of the month, you'll have completed 30 actions. Make a plan and stick to it. All you ever have to do is the next best thing. A word on money and value. We grew up with the idea that we have to work to earn money. This may be among the worst ways to earn money. Figure out how to bring value to others, how to provide them your service or product, and you'll be rewarded, but you have to ask. Going to work should be for satisfaction, not for money. If you view your job as where you get your satisfaction rather than your money, you can set up different ways of serving people where you can earn money. You don't even have to be there. You can earn it while you're sleeping. The key to making money is creating value and doing it consistently. People pay you when you add value to their lives. They reward you when they feel the value is there when you're asked. When you ask, and money is simply a symbol of that value. When you do a presentation or do a sample session or initially engage a potential client, rather than thinking about money or having to close the deal, think, how can I add value? Money and value are both perception. And now a final word on successful and productive work. Here are some principles related to career that I've come to see and I wanted to conclude with. 1, time is not an adequate measure of hard work. 2, hard work is not an adequate measure of performance or success. 3, a work ethic is not the same as a productivity or a success ethic. If possible, delegate everything other than what you do uniquely well, better than anyone else. Time management is energy management. Stress regulation is energy management. 7, follow your passion. 8, know your optimum state of mind, your zone to accomplish each specific task. 9, know how to enter your optimum state of mind, how to get to your zone. 10, when your passion and your expertise combine, deciding possibilities occur. And 11, structure gives you freedom, because that's what I'm talking about in making these plans and this structure, is that you have the freedom then to work within it and to be informed by it. Now, we have a few minutes. Thoughts, questions, things that would be more helpful for you to talk about in terms of career, your practice, your marketing, the business aspects of your career? Anything at all. I'll be happy to discuss any aspect of business, marketing, your coaching practice? Anything that yes.
Yeah, I have a question. This is Robin.
Uh-huh.
I'm very interested in the whole notion of branding and how you develop a brand for yourself. And how you come, I guess it would be an exercise in really narrowing down what you consider to be your unique value that you bring and shaping that and being.
I will send you an outline, an exercise about branding that I have, that I've constructed in case it would be helpful to you.
Okay.
I think about, but let me just tell you how I think about it, because you won't see anywhere my statement of my brand, but and that's what I mean about an internal conceptualization. But here's how I conceptualize my brand, that I integrate the mind and brain sciences to strategic coaching to help someone write the next story of their life or their business, and particularly professionals and executives. So in the mind and brain sciences, I'm particularly talking about psychology, neuroscience, behavioral economics, neuroeconomics, any of the mind and brain sciences, because that helps us to understand how to engage the mind and the brain with behavior to make changes that last. So I believe doing that can be the most effective way to facilitate change of anything that we know, because so many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. I mean, so just in a succinct way, that I integrate the mind and brain sciences with strategic coaching to help make changes that last. And that applies to individual clients. It applies to the training that I'm doing, that we're doing right now. It applies to the program that I have to help an organization develop an internal mentoring program by utilizing neuroscience-informed strategies about conversational intelligence, social intelligence, emotional intelligence, with the principles, the tools and method principles of mentor coaching in having conversations with people. So it's a just a way that you conceptualize what you do, but everything that you do is consistent with that, so that you're not doing one thing that would look like one brand and one with another. Think about it this way. Everything that you think of with Nike orbits around performance. They're swoosh. That's about performance. It's an action symbol. If I were to assemble a team of some of the best researchers in the world to create the best breakfast cereal ever invented, and after 3 years of doing this, I come up with a product that is absolutely unequivocally the best breakfast cereal in the history of the world, I go to Nike to say, hey, I've got the best breakfast cereal in the history of the world. Now, how long do you think it would take for them to decide to spend any man hours? It would take a very peripheral person less than a minute. You know, thanks, but that's not what we do. They would not need to assemble a board of directors or a team of experts of R&D or new product development to spend an hour or two meeting with me. They would save immense time because they have a brand, and everything they do is consistent to it. A brand can help you make decisions by immediately deciding, does that fit my brand or not? As you get more and more successful, there are going to be all kinds of people who want a piece of you. They want you to do presentations. They want you to affiliate with them. They want all kinds of things. They'll want you to work with them in various ways, from coaching to other things. If you have a consistent focus and trajectory, and think of brand as what informs you, the trajectory of your business, a lot of things can be an easy decision about your business. So let me send that branding aspect, and let me see if I can find a business plan template. That might be of help to you, too. So I'll get those together and send them off to you, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. Well, we're out of time. If there's anything more about this, we'll talk about it at the beginning of next time. And we hope Paola will join us next time. She's going to be presenting the roadmap, her roadmap case study. So thanks, and have a great rest of the week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.